This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. When examining the full scope of information sharing and protection, there are many widespread and complex challenges that must be addressed and solved by multiple agencies and organizations together. The Boston Marathon bombing was a serious reminder of the importance of connecting the dots as a way to keep our cities and neighborhoods safe. More recently, the nation's security was compromised because an insider disclosed classified information to the news media. Both events underscore the importance of strengthening information sharing and safeguarding in tandem. To do this right involves cultivating a horizontal, cross-cutting, data-centric information sharing and protection capability. What is the national strategy for information sharing and safeguarding? How has information sharing matured across the information sharing environment, the ISE? And what are the biggest challenges facing the ISE? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Shmendra Paul, Program Manager for the Information Sharing Environment. Shmendra, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you.
Well, thank you for having me. Glad to be here, Michael.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Melinda Balthrop. Melinda, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Shmendra, it would be helpful to provide some context. So what exactly is the Information Sharing Environment, or ISE, and what are some practical ways of thinking about ISE?
Well, that's a great question. I get it a lot. The information sharing environment is a series of distributed capabilities that are put in place by our different mission partners, federal agencies, state, local, tribal agencies, private sector entities. These capabilities allow for sharing responsibly information to advance the counterterrorism homeland security mission. So examples that are tangible are things like the National Network of Fusion Centers that are owned by the states or major metropolitan areas. The Nationwide Suspicious Activity Reporting Initiative, better known through a public awareness campaign, if you see something, say something. Sensitive but unclassified networks like FBI's Law Enforcement Online or DHS's Homeland Security Information Network. And federal programs and applications that interact with other agencies around the counterterrorism Homeland Security mission.
Well, that's a good way to start. And I'd like to understand the mission of your office, the Office of Program Manager for the ISE. How has it evolved since its inception?
Let me start with a vision. Our vision is national security through responsible information sharing. Now, we have a three-part mission. The first part is to advance the Homeland Security counterterrorism mission. The second part is to support a shift in culture from information ownership to information stewardship. The third part is to build partnerships and capacity for transformation among our myriad mission partners. Now, how has our mission evolved? We started with a strong focus on terrorism. We still have that. That's our bedrock, terrorism-related information sharing. But in 2007, the Congress added Homeland Security Information Sharing, WMD-related information sharing. Post-WikiLeaks, we took on a classified information sharing and safeguarding mission. And most recently, the White House and agencies have agreed to us taking a leadership role around cybersecurity information sharing, specifically chairing something called the Executive Committee to implement the information sharing architecture that came out of the so-called CNCI-5, the Connect the Centers initiative. This is focused on the internal plumbing of the government across the different agencies, right around things like incidents, indicators, and malware. There's been a lot of good work going on, and you know, the specifics of our role, we really are a planning, coordination, and performance monitoring and management function, you know, that works closely with the White House supporting agency activity.
With such a critical cross-agency government-wide mission, I'd like to get a sense of how the PMISC is organized. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure, Melinda. We have three primary divisions that are where the bulk of the activity occurs. The first division is Mission Programs. That works with our federal, state, local mission-side stakeholders, helping to understand their requirements, harmonize policy, be able to identify the specifics of how to codify the requirements around needed interoperable capabilities. The second group is assured interoperability. Here we're focused on building out the reference architectures and the frameworks that allow for defining business requirements by mission programs, as well as working with federal agencies, the CIO community, as well as industry standards organizations and the like, right? Because we have a big focus on working with industry and industry associations to get adoption of the frameworks like the National Information Exchange Model or the Federal Identity Credential and Access Management Roadmap. The third group is management and oversight. That focuses on working with the agencies to support our governance activities, right? I co-chair a White House-based governance committee, Information Sharing and Access Committee. We support the Senior Information Sharing and Safeguarding Steering Committee that's co-chaired by the National Security Staff and OMB. So that function is supporting the operation of the governance activity and also instrumenting with a focus on performance. Are we, you know, moving forward on implementing the required capabilities? Are those capabilities giving us the targeted outcomes? So those are the three main organizations. And it matches to some extent with the three-part mission I talked about earlier.
Shmendra, what are your specific responsibilities as a program manager? And given that the PMISC does not have an operational mandate, how do you employ collaborative leadership to meet your mission and work successfully across agencies and disciplines?
Yeah, that's a great question. Great question, Melinda. I talked earlier about how the role of the office really is to plan, coordinate, and monitor, right? And the law says plan, manage, oversee, but it doesn't quite work that way, right? The chain of command goes from the president to agency heads, and then the federal government really can't task state and local governments. So it really is about collaborative leadership. The core power we have is the power to convene. We have a legal and a moral authority around convening relating to counterterrorism, homeland security missions, and we've used that effectively. We've been described as an honest broker, bringing in the myriad of stakeholders and making sure their voices are heard in the process. I do think that we're able to bring some non-traditional tools, right, that help with the collaboration activity. I talked about the governance, right? So that's critical, and it's something that we do, but it's not enough. That's the traditional top-down type approach. We also have this connectivity to mission programs. If you look in our annual report to Congress recently released, you'll find 100 success stories. More or less about 100 success stories that talk about how specific communities of interest, specific programs, federal, state, local, are leveraging ISE frameworks to drive responsible information sharing. So we've got that sort of bottom-up piece, that connectivity to the mission. And then the third piece is our information interoperability frameworks, the standards and architecture approach, and the work we have with industry. There's been a lot of movement on industry adoption of these frameworks, things like the National Information Exchange Model, the Federal Identity Credential and Access Management Roadmap. And it's not a one-way conversation. You know, we are actually leveraging a lot of mainstream industry work around standards and approaches to interoperability and bringing that in and making sure that that's baked into how we operate. So it's those multiple levels of activity that really, I think, give us the ability to help support agencies that want to be able to be more effective with it, both from a cost perspective and a mission perspective on this in this area.
And so it's a unique charge. You're doing a lot of things. It's got to be challenging, and I want to explore some of the challenges you face. Could you tell us maybe the three top challenges you're facing and how you sought to address them?
Yeah, I can do that, Michael. The first challenge is the evolving and converging threat. Our office is a direct line out of the events, tragic events of 9/11, right? So you've got a large-scale organized plot originating overseas. The threat picture has evolved. There's much more of a focus, or, you know, it's more dynamic. There's the lone wolf type scenarios, right? The homegrown activity, the violent extremism. You also have the cyber, which is, you know, the number one threat these days, right, according to leaders across the government. And, you know, there's a merging of cyber and physical, right, coming together, thinking about our critical infrastructure sort of thing. So the number one challenge we have is the fact that the threat picture is incredibly diverse and interlinked. You know, number two is a need to continue on the journey of changing organizational cultures, right? A big focus on changing culture, a big focus on that at the individual level, right? A big focus post 9/11 on information sharing, more recently responsible information sharing, right, to make sure that we're not just sharing for sharing's sake, but sharing in the context of a mission requirement to make better decisions to protect the American people. So, you know, as we have that basic level of culture change, we need to be more focused on organizational culture change, right, which comes from governance and performance management. This is something that's bigger than my activity, right? This is kind of the classic thing in large-scale government, kind of government reform activities. How do you work horizontally in a vertical world? So that's a big challenge for us. I think the third big challenge is the financial crisis that we have in the public sector. You know, post the crash several years ago, the state and local community absorbed those budget cuts sooner. They were worse, actually, at the state and local level. At the state and local level, there's been a stabilization and, in some cases, you know, an increase in revenue. At the federal level now, I mean, it's really a big topic. You just read the front page of the paper these days, and you see, how we're, coming to terms with the budget cuts at the federal level. So that's causing some stress. It's not all negative. There's, some that, and I tend to subscribe to this too, that there's a positive lining to this in terms of forcing creativity and a focus on collaborative approaches. But it's very disruptive, and it does make it challenging.
Mr. Major, what surprised you most since taking your role?
You know, what's surprised me most is, in spite of all of those challenges, the real sense of shared mission and community across so many different stakeholders. It's the thing that keeps me going and is really, really wonderful to be a part of a community, multiple communities, but all have shared focus on improving information sharing, responsible information sharing, on mission fulfillment. You know, the degree to which whole of government has really been inculcated into the fabric of the public sector. And, you know, you can understand it in the counterterrorism area, right, the law enforcement community, the intelligence community, the homeland security community, but it goes more broad. There really is a post 9/11 and over the last number of years, whether it's because of the consumerization of technology, whether it's because of, you know, cost imperatives, there really is a focus on whole of government approaches, and so that's actually a positive thing. But that's been a little bit of a surprise for me.
We're getting ready to publish a special report by the IBM Center, the 6 trends driving change in government, and one of those trends is leadership, and it's leading in an era of complex challenges, and your role, as Melinda pointed out, collaborative leadership is essential in that kind of thing, because not one agency has all the solutions. And I've asked you this question before, but I'd like to get your sense with that kind of rubric of collaborative leadership. What makes an effective leader today when you have to lead in an era of complex challenges?
I think it's several things. Number one is an unrelenting focus on the mission, the outcome, right? Who is the end user and how does that value chain work to support the end user? And you know, if you keep that always in mind, people are much more open to collaboration and you know, more forgiving of missteps or of the bumps along the way that are inevitable in large-scale collaboration activities. So that focus on the mission, you know, authentically on the mission, and that's I think the number one thing. I think number two is being respectful of different folks' equities, points of view, and finding a way to integrate those. People talk about diversity a lot, and you know, a lot of times that's focused on demographic diversity, and that's very important. But one of the things that we find in our role is that in our office, one of the things I'm proudest of is the degree of functional diversity and representation of the myriad stakeholders across my mission space. You know, can see themselves in the office, whether it's state and locals, whether it's tribal law enforcement, whether it's intelligence, homeland security community, whether it's the CIO community. I mean, so that having that kind of diversity is important for this kind of thing. I think the other thing I'd highlight here is a willingness to try different approaches. I highlighted this three-pronged approach of the top-down governance, but top-down not being enough, being connected to the mission, the bottom-up, and then working with industry on the standards-based approaches. Any one of those would have been interesting, would have been allowed us to move the ball, but not really enough. I think that the combination gives us much more than the sum of the parts of, you know, so that having a little bit of creativity is, I think, critical too.
What is the national strategy for information sharing and safeguarding? We will ask Smendra Paul, Program Manager for ISE, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is fast government and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How are changing work habits and technology decreasing the federal government's real estate footprint? And how are VA and HUD working to end chronic homelessness among veterans? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We go beyond the buzz to introduce and connect our readers to actual public sector executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Smendra Paul, Program Manager for the Information Sharing Environment. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Melinda Bouthrop. So, Smendra, since you last visited us, the administration released the National Strategy for Information Sharing and Safeguarding in December 2012. I'd like to know more about it. Would you tell us more about the guiding principles that form the foundation of the strategy? And could you perhaps describe the five goals that outline it?
Yes. The release of the strategy signed up by the president back in December, the National Strategy for Information Sharing and Safeguarding, was, in my community, a real seminal event. Three core principles in the strategy. Number one, information is a national asset. What we mean by that, what the president means by that, is information has a life cycle. As an asset, it has to be safeguarded. Safeguarded both from an information security perspective, an access perspective, as well as from the perspective for protecting the privacy of individuals to the extent that they're represented in that information. As an asset, you create value by sharing it and using it. Information is an intangible asset, right? So there's no cost necessarily to sharing it and using it, the extent to which you're safeguarding it also. So thinking about information is the key. When you pull a thread on that principle, what happens? You realize we spend a lot of money on information technology. The federal budget on the civilian side is about $80 billion a year, but almost all of that goes to buy information technology. It's about buying systems. It's about buying applications. It's about buying operational transaction systems, right, and then figuring out after the fact how to extract the information and getting value out of it, right? So if you invert that paradigm and think about what I really want to do is to buy information management over a life cycle, it takes you down a different path, right? So that's a critical principle. Second principle is that we need to do shared risk management between sharing and safeguarding. Traditionally, you've had mission folks focused on sharing to enable the mission. You've had security folks focused on, you know, the safeguarding aspects of it. It's been difficult to reconcile those conversations. When push comes to shove, sometimes you make decisions that don't are not reflective of the true risk. I think that that was some of the aftermath of the WikiLeaks, episode, right, with sharing in theater and the like. So shared risk management, and, you know, the embodiment of this is the, you know, post-WikiLeaks, the executive order called for the creation of the Senior Information Sharing and Safeguarding Committee in the White House, co-chaired by the National Security Staff and OMB. Really, the first time you're bringing together sharing and safeguarding in such a direct way. And, you know, they've been driving initiatives like improving identity management, access control, enterprise audit, and things like that. So, you know, again, the embodiment that if to the extent you're doing a job with modern safeguarding kind of approaches, you have more confidence to share. So shared risk management. The third principle is back what we used to call in high school English a tautology, right? An obvious statement that when you pull on it, actually has a lot of power. So the point of information sharing is to make better decisions. Right. So pulling a thread on that, where does that take you? Well, start with the decisions you want to make or the classes of decisions and understand the information requirements they drive and then make policy based on that. The Markle Foundation, which wrote a lot of seminal documents that, you know, really are the blueprint for what we're doing here with the information sharing environment, call that authorized use. Okay. So, you know, we're, you know, reflecting on a principle here, the the idea of authorized use, that we want to move towards developing policy and focusing on requirements based on classes of decisions versus classes of information. Now, that's not, you know, those principles are great. It takes a lot of work to actually figure out how to actuate them, right? And that's what we're doing. And that goes to the 5 goals and the 16 priority objectives in the strategy.
And could you identify those goals, just the 5?
Yes. The goal number 1 is collective action through collaboration and accountability. That's really focused on coalescing communities of interest and having effective authoritative governance that can define then the requirements and help meet those requirements. Goal number 2 is information discovery and access through common standards, a real focus of the office I lead and critical to how we engage with industry. Number 3 is optimizing mission effectiveness through shared services and interoperability. This is actually delivering capabilities that are interoperable, that are standards-based. They could be supported in a cloud as a managed service, a shared service, or point application. This also emphasizes the standards-based acquisition ideas. The 4th is strengthening safeguarding of information. And the 5th is protecting privacy, civil rights, and civil liberties.
With the new and evolving threats that you talked about earlier, the increasing amounts of data to manage in a constrained fiscal environment, can you talk more about the biggest challenges facing the ISC and the various agencies and communities that operate in and own this environment? Also, what are some of the core capabilities and tools that you use to assist them in overcoming these challenges and in spreading the adoption of best practices?
Now, that's a good question, and the way I'd like to answer it is to focus in on some specific things that we're doing to make it tangible to your listeners. We've been working for some time to drive interoperability of the nation's sensitive but unclassified networks. So 4 in particular, FBI's LEO, Law Enforcement Online, DHS's HISN, Homeland Security Information Network, DOJ's grant-funded state-owned RISNET, and then IntelLink, which is from the intelligence community. These networks have several hundred thousand users, federal, state, local. They support a myriad of missions, law enforcement, public safety, homeland security, counterterrorism. They're the primary sensitive and unclassified means for communicating broad-based. You know, over the last number of years, we've been focusing on a no wrong door strategy, right? Earlier, it used to be, let's pick one. Well, that didn't work because of the bureaucratic antibodies that come up. And really, it's, while it has a certain appeal, it's maybe oversimplifies the problem. So we've been focusing on common standards for interoperability at a variety of different levels. So one of the first initiatives was getting a common help desk, or at least having the help desks know about each of the other networks. So if somebody wanted to get to another network and they called the helpline number, they get an answer. So a small thing, but really very valuable to the end users. More recently, there's been a real focus on common identity and access management, right? Because to the extent that you know who you're dealing with and can be able to automate policy and access. So there's a move now to implement that. And recently, one of the things we did, and we have a small amount of money we can use to help seed implementation, we partnered with the General Services Administration to build something called a back-end attribute exchange. So this is a service, a capability that's operated by GSA as a shared service to be able to securely exchange across different trading partners at certain attribute information. And we piloted this with the Texas Department of Public Safety and several other agencies, federal agencies, and it was around sharing an attribute authoritatively that an individual had training to see a certain class of information, knew the rules about handling that information. And so it was a successful pilot. It's talked about at more length in the annual report to Congress. You can find that on our website, www.isc.gov. And also this service, the thing I'd like to add, was called for as one of the key capabilities in the FICAM roadmap, the Federal Identity Credential and Access Management Roadmap. We wanted to do this with GSA because they're the lead on the FICAM as well as a natural place to do a shared service at the civilian sort of level.
It sounds like collective action through collaboration and accountability is key to the success of your efforts. Foundational ISC mission processes continue to mature. Would you tell us more about new and emerging information sharing initiatives in both traditional terrorism and homeland security missions and other missions that collect and maintain data to support traditional ISC mission processes? Also, can you highlight some accomplishments and opportunities for additional improvements in this area?
Melinda, what I want to do is answer with 2 examples, one on sort of with our traditional initiatives, but with a slightly new mission area and then a slightly new mission area. So in our traditional applications, we've been working with the National Network of Fusion Centers, but also the HIDAs, the high-intensity drug trafficking areas, and the RIS net. So many have commented on, okay, so we've got the fusion centers and the war on terror, we've got the HIDAs from the war on drugs, we've got the RIS center from the war on regional crime going back to the 70s. Is there duplication and overlap with these field-based information sharing entities? And the answer is no, they service different missions, but there are opportunities for greater alignment because of the evolving and converging nature of the threat. So a critical public safety issue for our constituencies has been deconfliction, sort of the so-called blue on blue. It's an officer safety issue. It's also a smart resource allocation issue and a key to effective operational collaboration. Many different deconfliction systems, some operated by RIS, some operated by the HIDAS, some operated at the federal level. These deconfliction systems historically were not interoperable. This has been a key focus for the Attorney General over the last few years, and our stakeholders came to us a few years back, asked for our help and sponsorship as an honest broker to help catalyze activity. Well, I'm happy to report that we've actually, with our federal partners, DOJ, DEA, and others, DHS, have been able to support the state and local community primarily to drive interoperability across these different initiatives. So now we're at a place where there's active work to bridge these different deconfliction systems so that they deconflict across the systems. There's also a unified message that's coming out through the state and local governance structures, the professional associations that are in the law enforcement space, a unified message about the goodness of doing deconfliction to make sure we get everybody doing deconfliction. So that's a great example, you know, sort of in our traditional space. In the new space, a new mission we've taken on is around cybersecurity. So I think I talked earlier about this executive committee that we're helping to facilitate, you know, really to help align existing agency-based activity. A lot of good work in the agencies. Our value add is in terms of planning, coordination, performance monitoring, and things like that, and providing a forum for, you know, the work to go forward. But in particular with our state and local partners, over the last year, we've partnered with the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the State Association of Criminal Investigative Agencies, the National Network of Fusion Centers, with DHS, NPPD, with FBI, to catalyze a new project that we're actually doing in partnership specifically with DHS as the lead on it, to work with the Multi-State Information Sharing, Information Analysis and Sharing Council, right, to work with the law enforcement community to develop requirements around several use cases, things like protecting government networks or investigating cybercrime or victim notification, things like that. So the feedback from our state and local partners is that this is great. They're really at the front end of this sort of new big area. We're getting better unity of effort, better integration. And really where it's coming from is, and we're just a catalyst for it, but the real driver here is the desire across the board, federal, state, local, to leverage the lessons learned over the past decade on homeland security and counterterrorism information sharing as we move into cybersecurity information sharing.
Mr. Manager, you mentioned earlier any initiatives or the goal of information discovery and access, which basically is the process that enables you to identify the existence of information and retrieve it. Could you tell us a little bit more about what's going on, what's been accomplished over the last year, where you might need some improvements, and more particularly, how does the pursuit of common standards factor into your initiatives under this goal?
So common standards have huge power, especially when they're developed transparently with a community of interest of stakeholders involved with effective governance and with the involvement of industry, right, and through recognize reputable existing international standards development organizations. So, you know, a critical initiative in this area that we've been involved with for the last few years is with our core National Information Exchange Model framework, right? The NEEM is core to how we define the data interoperability. So it's gotten NEEM huge uptake in the public sector, a lot of use at the state and local level. Much broader than its original law enforcement focus. DOD recently adopted a NEEM-first policy and is working through the implementation guidance on that. It's used extensively in the human services area. So it's used pretty broadly. What we've been doing is working with a group called the Object Management Group and with the NEEM community to express NEEM as a UML profile. UML is a universal modeling language. It's the lingua franca for information management. So by doing this, it puts it in the mainstream of a model-driven architecture type approaches. And so there's a very large body of tools in the UML space There are several vendors now that ship tools in that space that have plugins for doing Neem. So you're reducing the making it easier to use Neem using visual tools to develop the architectural specifications. Now, the second effort we're doing with this group is around a service-oriented architecture specification language. Right, so this will then allow you to take the specifications and then, by using this additional standard, actually develop web services, whether they're WSDL SOAP type, whether they're RESTful. Right, so folks are already thinking about, okay, RESTful services using JSON, right, on mobile devices, as well as the heavier weight type approaches with WSDL services. So you're starting to see that you can maybe manage the information across this lifecycle, the specification, the implementation of services. Those services have a policy layer that would implement security and privacy policy. You'd update that. So it's just a different, more modular approach, right? And so this is kind of a critical initiative for us, and one where we're getting a fair degree of traction and excitement.
Well, that sounds good. I was wondering about your efforts to optimize mission effectiveness through, say, shared services. Could you elaborate on your efforts and initiatives that increase efficiency, reduce duplication, and improve mission success? What are you doing in this area?
Yeah, there's a few things. I think I'd like to pull the thread on the standards and what that can do to help on this. So with ACT-IAC and with GSA, as a co-sponsor, I worked with ACT-IAC and asked them about a year ago to do more than a year ago, and they delivered it about 10, 12 months ago, a white paper on recommendations around standards-based acquisition, right? Again, the idea being that if you have these sort of these standards that formalize business requirements for interoperability, industry is supporting them, can we actually procure interoperable solutions? So we got feedback from ACT-IAC, with very robust feedback about how to do this, and it talked about to make it work at the point of procurement, you got to start 18, 24 months earlier, right, when you're defining requirements. But the beauty is by using these frameworks, you have then a formal framework for defining the requirements to know when they're complete. To make this sort of an approach work, too, you needed an industry-based certification approach. So let's say somebody in industry actually wanted to invest in implementing these. How do they know that they're not going to be undercut by somebody that's claiming to have it but doesn't, right? So there has to be a good housekeeping seal of approval on implementations. Well, so we've worked with another industry group called the IGES Institute, right, very big in the law enforcement public safety space. They have an initiative they call Springboard, which is industry-based certification of conformance of interoperability. So now you can start to see, okay, if you've got the program side defining requirements formally in a community of interest with authoritative governance, you've got the industry side involved both in the standards organizations and the industry associations, there's a place where vendors can go to get the good housekeeping seal of approval on their implementations, then the contracting officer can actually do a procurement for a standards-enabled solution. So we're seeing this. The premier example of this was around prescription drug diversion. Two statistics blow my mind. Maybe you'll have the same reaction. It turns out that 1 in 5 teenagers in this country experiments with prescription drugs. You know, another data point is that in the state of California, only about 20% of the scripts written are for in-state residents. There's a big traffic, and a lot of this is legitimate, but there's a big interstate trafficking around, and it's gray market, black market, right? And it's the number one narcotics problem in this country, dollar value. Well, so there's been a big effort funded through federal grants. They're called Hal Rogers grants, right? And they're at the intersection of public safety and public health. Can you share this information? Can the pharmacy share this information with public safety in a controlled way, respecting privacy, but being able to provide the clues that allow folks to know they shouldn't be, filling prescriptions or, to be able to identify hotspots or pill mills and things like that. Well, this was the first application of this Springboard process over at IGES, and it worked. And the vendors that went through the process were health IT vendors, pharmacy vendors. They weren't the law enforcement vendors, right? And so it's being deployed across the country right now. It's one of these big success stories of using these kinds of approaches. So you have these shared interoperable capabilities that are standards-based. Then because they're standards-based, the lifecycle O&M costs are going to be tremendously lower, right? And again, it goes back to this idea that you're focusing on information as the asset, not the IT.
Well, you've mentioned a couple of times interoperability. What are you doing to forge that throughout the ISE? And what are some challenges associated with actually achieving interoperability?
So, interoperability is one of these, open-ended problems like search, right? You can always build a bigger search engine. So it's a question about getting incrementally more interoperable, introducing process improvements, right? And then, you know, creating a virtuous cycle where people buy into, you know, certain approaches, and then in having a roadmap for those approaches. So we've done a lot. I've talked about a lot of things, but one of my big challenges personally for the office is to better package what we're doing and making it easier to use, more understandable, you know, to open the circle, so to speak. So we've been focusing on something called the ISE interoperability framework as an update to a codification for lack of a better way of saying it, the secret sauce of interoperability, the frameworks that have been driven out of our office. So we have an initial version of this that we've got out now with the agencies, and it's fine as it is, but now the focus is to piloting it with certain communities of interest. So we're working with our agency partners, our federal, state, local. We have some candidates in mind, and maybe when I come back next year, I'll be able to tell you about the successes we've had. But the hope here is that by packaging things, right, that are rooted in these mainstream standards, right, with, you know, templates and how-to, as well as the more technical work, we can make it easier to use.
How has information sharing matured across the information sharing environment? We will ask Smidger Paul, Program Manager for ISE, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How can serendipitous collision change the way agencies do business? How are changing work habits and technology decreasing the federal government's footprint? Get your latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We go beyond the buzz to introduce and connect our readers to actual public sector executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Get your free copy at businessofgovernment.org.
What are the Defense Logistics Agency's strategic priorities? How is DLA working to reduce costs while improving support to the warfighter? What about DLA's role in providing humanitarian assistance and disaster relief support? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and so much more with Vice Admiral Mark D. Hartnachuk, Director of the Defense Logistics Agency, next week on the Business of Government Hour. Tune in every Monday at 11 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Smidger Paul, Program Manager for the Information Sharing Environment. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Melinda Balthrop. So, Smidger, we discussed before, and I'd like to get your insights again on your efforts to create a culture of sharing. And would you tell us how you're sort of doing that and changing the culture of this is mine to this is ours?
So the efforts in the past have had a primary focus on individual culture, right, calculating the idea that responsible information sharing is everybody's job, and we're still continuing that. One of the priority objectives out of the new national strategy the president just released is to training, and as to fulfill that, we're going to be updating our ISE information sharing environment core awareness training. And those updates will include more weight on the safeguarding side, right, sharing and safeguarding, the shared risk management ideas we talked about earlier. But the primary thing we're doing is a focus on organizational change, and the way we're trying to drive that is through a focus on accountability and performance management, right? So you get the result you manage for. This is something that, you know, really is an observation, transcends information sharing. You know, we exist in a stovepiped world in terms of the public sector, and we do a better job managing specific programs, and most of those programs, you know, react to that management pressure and improve as point programs. But when you try to do a crosscut, you know, going across an agency is hard enough, going across the federal government, going across communities, going across levels of government into the private sector, you know, that's where we live in. So it's critical to have an authoritative, accepted view on performance and our folks following through on commitments and things like that. So the annual report to Congress that we just issued, which, you know, again, you can find on our website, www.ise.gov, it's pretty exhaustive. And, you know, some tease me that it's exhausting. I don't feel that way. But the reason it's the way it is because it is the capstone of our performance management activities. So it's not just a report to Congress. It serves that purpose. But it's also a transparent and authoritative assessment of how we're doing that anchors in what we said we were going to do last year, that talks about specific gaps, both granular level gaps that are agency specific, as well as systemic challenges. And it talks about the commitments we're making as a government over the next 12 months that we're going to report on again next year. I think this is worth dwelling on in the context of the open government movement.
Yes.
Right? President Obama, first day in office, signed out the open government memo, the open government policy. Government's going to be transparent, participatory, collaborative. Incredible transparency at the heart of the counterterrorism homeland security enterprise. Participation. Right? We've got involvement from a variety of different folks, industry, state and local, you know, federal players at all levels. And in collaborative, this idea of whole of government is really at the heart of what we do. So it's a different view on open government, but fully embracing those principles.
I think we'd all agree that the recent information breaches and disclosures highlight vulnerabilities in the protection of sensitive and classified information. As a result, sharing and safeguarding information has become increasingly important. Would you describe key achievements over the past year in safeguarding the capabilities that most directly relate to the advancement of information sharing? And from your perspective, what is being done to drive improvements in this area?
So you're right. The unauthorized disclosures to the media of classified information go to, you know, create huge damage and are really very, very troublesome. The things that we've done over the last little while since the last report include furthering identity management type activities. Again, it's the idea that sharing and safeguarding are two sides of the same coin. So to the extent we can do a better job on identity management and that identity works across boundaries on a security fabric, whether it's at the sensitive and unclassified level or in the classified fabrics, it increases our security posture. Removable media. We've made advances in terms of demonstrably implementing a removable media policy that have been around for a while. So there's a, you know, the annual report talks about some of these things. I think that there's also, you know, a cross-agency performance goal around cybersecurity, right, that also is published every quarter that has some metrics around where we are with the different initiatives around continuous monitoring and identity and access control. And so there's been some movement there, but a real focus on doing more in terms of that.
Would you share your efforts to balance information needs with civil liberties and compliance activities? What are the specific challenges being faced and what progress has been made? And from your view, again, what more needs to be done?
So in the last year, federal agencies have closed a substantial gap in terms of basic privacy policies that are as comprehensive as the president's ISE privacy guidelines. So in last year's report, we talked about how the state and local community had closed that gap as it related to the National Network of Fusion Centers. And a big driver on that last year was special condition language on grants going out. In the last couple of years, we put a big focus on getting the last few agencies, and we're almost there in terms of federal agencies having the privacy policies in place. The one that doesn't, they have policies in place. This is more of a technical discussion about those policies versus an ISE-specific policy. So, you know, we feel pretty good about where we are in that regard. There is a shift now where we're looking at more about privacy policy automation and compliance, right? So we think that, you know, having the basics of the policies is good, and that's important. Now we need to make sure that there's a views on compliance, right, so which involves inspections or audit or peer reviews, and then moving towards automation, right? And we think that's really the future here. And that's critical from an information sharing perspective. Right now, when you have sensitive information, I hate to say it, but most of the state of the art here is individual point-to-point information sharing agreements with handcrafted arrangements around privacy, security, right. So we want to, you know, we want to move towards having more of a multilateral approach with more common policy requirements that are more formalized and automatable. So we're working that.
Continuing down that path, would you tell us more about your efforts to improve oversight and mature the management functions that support information sharing and safeguarding? To what extent do your efforts involve aligning governance bodies, managing performance, training, and developing incentives for information sharing and safeguarding throughout the ISC? Are there opportunities for improvement?
There are opportunities for improvement, but we've done a lot. We actually, and I've talked a little bit about the performance management focus of the office, so we really see that as critical. And one of the initiatives that we've been driving to improve the processes and to improve, make it easier for agencies to understand, you know, how to work with us and how to potentially improve their internal activities is an ISC management plan. So again, this is a early stage activity where we're trying to take the next step in terms of process improvement. So we've been operating for a number of years with agencies, with key mission partners across a variety of different areas. But we saw now the time to try to document, standardize, and improve those processes, in alignment with strategic management processes anchored at OMB. So let me give you some examples. We issue implementation guidance anchored in programmatic guidance that comes out of the White House on an annual basis. It's part of our annual performance cycle. The White House considers the National Strategy for Information Sharing and Safeguarding as programmatic guidance, right? So that's the capstone now, and it's been formalized in this context of strategy. Went through an interagency process. Everybody bought into it. We're using our implementation guidance to provide control milestones for implementing the 16 priority objectives. Right. So we've gone through a collaborative consensus process with our mission partners, developed an initial round, and have issued that as implementation guidance. Now we're looking to fill in the priority objectives where there was some additional work needed to get to a clean baseline and then enrich those plans. So we have a basic baseline, and we're looking to improve it, enhance it, and maintain it year over year. So these are some of the kind of key performance tools. Goes back to the goal number one, collective action through collaboration and accountability. Right. So the collaboration defines what we're going to do. The accountability, have we done it? Do we have a process to understand that? Right. So that's critical.
I'd like to keep on the whole management plan, and more particularly, how does having such a plan create or seek to create a unity of effort across government, and more particularly, how does it benefit stakeholders having such a plan?
Well, by having such a plan, it makes it easier for folks that are one step removed from our direct activities to understand what's happening, why it's happening, and how they can leverage these processes to their benefit. Right? One of the key balances you got to strike, are you coming across or are you viewed as a tax, right, an unfunded mandate, or are you viewed as accelerating the mission or an avenue towards realizing efficiencies through pooling resources or as somebody that's bringing assets to the table? Right? So, having a plan like this increases transparency, makes it easier to collaborate, and, when it's authoritative, it allows for folks to participate directly in, the ISE by bringing in their resources and having a vehicle to pool.
When do you expect to release this plan, or has it been released?
We're working with the interagency right now in terms of some review cycles. We intend to, I think, through the fall, sometime later this fall, release the plan. I don't want to overplay it. It's sure. It's the process we take is to have the plan as a kernel, a seed, if you like, right? Then we want to plant it with agencies where we're already working, where we're already driving mission value, but look at it as a process improvement type idea. So it's going to be out, and people will find it on the website, but it'll be in the context of soliciting input and also making sure that these pilot activities are transparent as sort of the way we want to operate more broadly, going forward.
Mr. Mentor, you mentioned the ISE implementation guidance, and I want to actually explore that a little bit more, particularly what are the challenges faced with doing that and issuing that, and what lessons have you learned?
Yeah, so it is challenging. I think the key to understanding this is to understand that there's a blend of authorities here, and the blend of authorities is what gives this process the juice to work. So I have the authority to issue guidance, rules, standards given to me, not me personally, but the office through the Intelligence Reform Terrorism Prevention Act, Section 1016 that created the ISE. But I also co-chair the Information Sharing and Access Interagency Policy Committee with the National Security Staff. So the role of the IPC, it works under the PPD-1 or the Presidential Policy Directive 1. It defines how agencies coordinate, right? So this is the authoritative place for agencies to come together. We sit, over in the White House complex and come to agreement on what it is we want to do. And that process is agency-based. Each of the 16 priority objectives has a agency-based stewardship, right? So the planning process happens in a collaborative way anchored in the agencies. So there's that natural tension about, is PMISC telling an agency what to do, or is the agency signing up? The agency has to sign up. It's got to be kind of transparent and open. Okay, so having a plan is great. But implementing it is the trick, right? So that's where the implementation guidance is very effective, because we are able to take that consensus agreement, identify the control milestones, review that again with our stakeholders, but as an authoritative body, as with the subject matter expertise we have in this area, add some value to it, do the dependency analysis and that sort of thing, and then put it out there. And then there's the follow-up, or how are we doing? And the follow-up isn't gotcha. It's about, okay, where are we? Do we need a little more time? Right. All of this is, planning. It's subject to availability of appropriations. Things happen, right? So, we consistently work with our partners to okay, you need a little more time, or, you know, let's understand that, let's talk about it. At least we're transparent about it. We're doing it as a group, and we're just moving these things forward. So, you know, if you look in the annual report, I've highlighted, you know, there's a table here and that highlights implementation guides items that are completed, some that are not completed. There is another set of implementation guide items that are still underway. So we're not really setting a baseline in the same way you baseline a program. This is at a higher level, right? When you baseline a program, you have the money, you have the appropriations, you have the requirements, you've worked through the issues. This is at a higher level. So the baseline we set isn't the same kind of thing. It's okay for things to shift at that level as long as it's transparent and managed. So that's what we help facilitate.
What does the future hold for the information sharing environment? We will ask Mentor Paul, Program Manager for ISE, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How are VA and HUD working to end chronic homelessness among veterans? What is national health security, and how do we get there as a country? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Smendra Paul, Program Manager for the Information Sharing Environment. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Melinda Bouthrop. So, Smendra, what are you doing to work with private sector and international partners on expanding responsible information sharing?
So the President's National Infrastructure Advisory Committee about 18 months ago issued a report that highlighted the opportunities to do more in terms of sharing intelligence and information with the private sector. I read that report, and I think the third line or fourth line in the executive summary was something like, while the government has done a lot of good things with the state and local governments, the private sector is lagging. So as I read that and as I read the report, I saw an opportunity to leverage the assets we put in place with the ISE, the National Network of Fusion Centers, for example. They'll say, why don't we leverage these assets to accelerate private sector integration? So working with my colleagues in ODNI, working with in particular DHS, both NPPD and INA, the FBI, and our state and local partners, we've been helping to put a focus on what can we do to accelerate the integration of the private sector into the core initiatives and assets. So that's been a pretty successful body of work, and it actually highlights many of the tremendous things that DHS is already doing, FBI is already doing, and opportunities to accelerate that work and to better align it. And also, I want to give a particular shout-out to the National Network of Fusion Centers. Mm-hmm. The different fusion centers have individually had strong private sector outreach in their areas of responsibility. What they've been doing, and something we've been encouraging, and they've done this with DHS in particular and FBI, is looking for opportunities to improve their outreach to the private sector as a network. So if a fusion center in San Francisco has a relationship with the refinery in Richmond around sharing threat information, is there an opportunity to, deal with the oil and gas sector at more of the sector level, at the national level, right, to identify best practices, scale up those types of relationships? So that's an effort that's underway, and actually in the National Fusion Center Association is having their annual meeting here in the Washington area in November, and they're, I think, going to be reporting out on some of this. So looking forward to hearing that.
In this era of fiscal constraint, it's critical that agency leaders act with strategic intent and keep their workforce motivated to meet the mission. Reflecting on your leadership as Program Manager ISE, would you tell us how you continue to keep people focused and motivated in the face of dramatic